Hi, everyone. My name is Denise, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Denise.
And I just celebrated 11 years yesterday. I have this little closet that I put all my medallions in, and they're all on a stand, and they're all on a case. And you can see 1 through 10, and I'll be getting that 11, you know? Never, ever did I think that, that I would get that, have that, and then have that, like that window, like it's like a, like I can see right through it. It's on the TV chest, like, and it's like, you know, it keeps me close because I worked for those coins. I worked for those, you know. Every year there was always something. There was a, you know, we work for all of that, for every footstep that we take into change. You know, and that we demonstrate the change that we made. Even if we take footsteps back, then we have to return because God makes us return, right? If it's not quite finished. He gives us the lessons all over again to have the opportunity to do them again. So it's like, you know, we do that. And every day I get to see, you know, those coins. And they're special coins because my sponsor buys me really special coins. And, you know, it's just an amazing gift. So last week, we did Bill's story, and I have to also say thank you so much for letting me be a part of this, because I sat in that chair for so long that, you know, it was it's interesting to be in this one, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And I, you know, out of fear, I took 3 weeks, of course, you know, because, I mean, I, you know, oof, that's a lot. You know, you get better, and this is a very healing experience to do, to tell your story and to work through the book and share what you've been through, and you can't even hit, you know, like a quarter of what has gone on in your life, you know, that much I do know, but I'll try to hit some, you know, stuff. But so we visited with Bill, and Bill, you know, as we said, we found some likenesses between Bill and ourselves, and you know, Bill's finding, he's questioning his sanity and why he can't stop on his own and why he keeps picking up. And then his friend Ebby comes in, and he thinks he's a little crazy and his gin will last throughout the day, you know, while he vows profess his religious beliefs on him. And something else happens instead, and Bill finds hope, and he immediately goes through the steps, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way through. So he's a believer now that a power greater than himself can do something for him. So, you know, and that's basically where Bill's at. So the second chapter is finding a spiritual way of life, you know. There is a solution. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. That's the promise, is to solve the drink problem. But don't forget, and I emphasize this pretty much, God will take care of all of our problems. All of our problems will be solved. It's I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all of my problems, at the bottom of page 13. We are average Americans. All sections of this country, many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. So true, you know. We would not be friends. Like, you know, I didn't have too many friends in the bar unless they were drinking, you know what I mean? And then when I stopped going to the bar, I didn't hear from him anyway. So we are people who are normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and understanding, which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy is in escape from the disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for everyone is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism, the common solution. So, you know, we're about to journey into finding that, you know, all that stuff that he was going through and, you know, all the stuff that we've been through ourselves, you know. How many mornings you woke up, oh my God. How many days you went into work, oh my God. How many days you were on the train with the big sunglasses, oh my God. You know, and how many times you had to stand from somebody like 3-4 feet away, so of course they couldn't get the aroma. And, you know, at least for me, that was big, you know. Sometimes 3 or 4 feet wasn't enough, you know. It was better that I wasn't in the room, you know. It's amazing how, like, we come in these rooms. I couldn't stand any of you when I first came. I wasn't supposed to be here. What was I going to do for the rest of my life? How was I going to meet people? You know, I mean, everything was like, you know, what? I mean, this was my life. Alcohol was my life, you know? I mean, how was I going to survive without that? I mean, and anyway, and then we come here and we find people. We start to, I know for me, the network was very important. And until I found that, things didn't really jive. I could come into many meetings and then I could stay and leave. But if I wasn't joining in to tell anybody about myself or for them to tell about themselves, even though I was very, very impatient about listening to anybody else because my drama and my problems were the most important thing. And I didn't have very much patience back then. I mean, all of these things that we learned from this book, I mean, I didn't know how to listen, and I didn't have patience, and I didn't know how to tell you, you know, what I was feeling, how I was feeling, just that, you know, I wanted a drink. And this was, I have no idea what I'm doing here, but I don't know how this helps, you know. And it's just, I think that this could be a helpful book for everybody in the world. After I've read it a number of times and come to believe that this book shows me a new lifestyle, a new way of living, and a new hope that I would have never, ever even questioned or even found out about. I don't care how many self-help books I could have read. You know, this actually gave me, you know, like a chance to really take a look at some real life issues that I would have never looked at. You know, like why I don't get along with you, why I don't like you, why I have a resentment against you. You know, why I'm so impatient. I mean, all of these things. Like you start to because we have our problems, and then they keep on coming, and keep on coming, they keep on coming, and they don't stop. And so we sit down and we do the work, and then all of a sudden some of these problems start to go away because we begin to understand ourselves. We start to sit still. We start to, you know, do all of that. And it might be foreign for some of the new people in here, you know, all of this. It's a lot of information, and this book carries a lot of information. So, you know, when you're going through this book, it's always much better if you're going through it with another person, because it's just not the type of book that you read by yourself. This is a book where it's shared with another person, and that person shares with you, and you share with that person. And you begin to understand how you relate to the problem at hand. And, you know, you're not so unique. You're not alone. You know, this is like something where, you know, there's a lot of people that are sharing the same thoughts and feelings and problems. Some bigger, some smaller, some different, some, you know, but you're not alone. And you begin to feel like you're a part of a bigger, you know, like a network of people that, like, they have hope. There's some sort of hope here. So this is what Bill had gathered a little bit, that he's got some hope now. So we hope that this volume will inform and comfort those who are or may be affected. There are many highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us and have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. But the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an alcoholic understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So us working with one another, we can sort of gain the confidence of another person for them to reach inside them, for them to be able to tell us what is going on with them. And finally, because, I mean, no doctor got any information out of me. Oh, yeah, I drank a couple of drinks. Mm-hmm. Only a couple. My liver tells you something different in all the enzymes, but only a couple. I don't know how that could be. You know? The man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is the man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful. And there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be enjoyed. These are conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up to their beds and walk again. That's another thing, you know, like a person in AA that's working the program. Like, you can approach them and you can talk to them about anything without judgment. The more that they've worked on the steps, the less judgment that there's going to be, basically. I mean, we still have judgments. I'm not going to say in opinions, and, you know, things go through our minds and we don't like certain things and we don't like certain people. But once we pause and we say, okay, you know, that person's that way, I'm this way, this one's that way, this one's that way, we can begin to have our differences be appreciated rather than be a battle for us. And, you know, God comes in and allows that to happen. And, you know, then there's the turnaround. Once again, we find the other side of the answer in order for us to move forward and accept those things without provocation. We don't need to step on our fellow's toes, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And it begins to be like a natural instinct. We appreciate, you know, I mean, people still get me mad, and I, you know, but it also generally has to do with me, like what kind of mood I'm in, what's been going on with me. I could use the term spiritually fit. Am I spiritually fit? But did I get enough rest? Did I eat right? You know, did something happen that's making me, you know, anxious and impatient and, you know, causing me worry? Did I pray? Did I talk to God? You know, when we worry, we think worry is just an outcrop of thinking we know more than the other person. So we're worried for them, right? So we know more. That's not true. So we need to go to God, and we need to ask God to take that worry, you know, from both persons, for the person that it's affecting and the worry that I'm showing all my concern, because I don't know all the answers, and I need to listen to God in order to find the answers. So, and we begin to do that naturally. You know, it's not like, you know, we have to go into this, like, monk thing and religious, you know. Ooh. Yeah. It comes just naturally. We just do it. Okay, so we have no axes to grind. So none of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think it's effective when we would be increased if we did. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principle lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we are going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. If we keep on the way we are going, there is little doubt that much good will result. But the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been given so freely to us? So, like, nobody would have known that there was anything really wrong with me had I never come out of my house. You know, as soon as I came out of my house, my family knew, my job knew something wasn't quite right. I was a little shaky, couldn't hold a cup of coffee. People were waiting to see what would happen. You know, I remember that my boss actually finally saw me, and the coffee was like, oh, put that down. I couldn't eat soup with a spoon, so I would never go out to lunch with you. I mean, I couldn't put makeup on. I had to, like, put makeup on like this. Order. When I was working, I had to have somebody write my orders because my hand would just, whoop. I couldn't write in front of the customer. I mean, all these things were obstacles, but did I think just that drinking had anything to do with this? Of course, I knew that it did. I didn't want to stop. If we keep on the way that we're, there's little doubt that much good. Okay, so we have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to task our combined experience and knowledge. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem. So you must experience this program. This is not one that, like, you can read this book and then you become the expert and say, because these sentences sort of change for everybody's experience. So, you know, you could keep, like, reading if you're not an alcoholic and probably not get too much about it, except that, oh, yeah, I remember that day I came in and I was a little, you know, toasted from the night before, and my employer, like, sort of said something to me. But if you're not a real alcoholic, this isn't happening, like, on an everyday basis or a monthly basis, whether you're a binge drinker or you're a daily drinker. I myself was a daily drinker, so it affected everything, you know, on every level. Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect of their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So I have a note here written, can't think good thoughts when stuck in bad thoughts. You know, and I know myself that, you know, I was constantly in the negative. I don't think that, like, I knew how to think positive. You know, I was just waiting for the floor to drop, you know, whatever I was doing. Like, you know, when was going to be the last day that I was going to work? When was going to be, you know, I was going to back up and, you know, bang into somebody? You know, I just didn't have, I just, you know, and today I, you know, there's not many days that I go by where it's just, I mean, I'm not going to say that it's all good thoughts, because my disease, we have that thing where it's morbid reflection, and we have to, and we waver up and down. We're on this, like, slope, and we waver from high to low, you know, and we want to get, like, some, like, some people that are alcoholic, like, need to go to a meeting, like, every day to keep them at that plateau. Some people, you know, need that meeting to bring them up, or they need excitement, or that wow factor, or whatever. And I've met many, and I found exercise and my yoga helps with that to keep me, like, on a midline rather than up, down, up, down. Let me find that point. I can find that point where I'm even. So, you know, which is really good because it keeps my thoughts and then my spiritual thinking and my really my asking of God to keep me in the direction of having those kind of thoughts, of helping other people, of doing all of this, of going in the right direction, of, you know, being successful here, helping somebody there, you know, like all of these kind of things with the direction of being healthy, healthy, healthy. Help me. I mean, I can't say for everyone, but that's what helped me a lot. You may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Because we did too much of it. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. Okay, so how many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. I mean, we've all heard these things. Why don't you try beer? Oh, my God. I went from hard alcohol to wine, you know. He could stop if he wanted to. Yeah, right. She's such a sweet girl. I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. I was told a thousand times. But there he is, all lit up again. Now these are, and you know, I had plenty of car accidents too. I had broken bones, lots of them. Do you think? No. Now these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is the world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. People who don't know this is an illness. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. So then they're going into the type of drinkers that we are. Then we have a certain type of a hard drinker. We may have it badly enough to gradually impair it physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning from the doctor, they can change that. But what about the real alcoholic? We may start off as a moderate drinker, and I know that I did. I mean, I started out with like Boone's Farm apple wine, right? And it was very good. And I thought it was very good. We all had a good time too, you know? But it wasn't every day. And then he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. I never thought that for a long time. Here is the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes distrustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight exactly at the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. I never understood that sentence for a really long time, and then I did, because everything, I would drink right before an important decision needed to be made. Wedding, this, I had to be there, job interview, whatever. You know, I would always do that, and I didn't realize that but you know, when I look back at it, you know, there was so much fear involved that I was not right inside in the first place. So alcohol helped me to get right inside. So of course it was a natural thing for me to take a drink of alcohol. But once I took a drink, then I couldn't stop drinking, so then all bets were off and I never made it to the occasion. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of himself. I'd still like to figure those ones out. I haven't figured all them out, but dishonest and selfish, yes, that was my middle name. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He is a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep around the clock, yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. So I remember the day that, I quit. I think I called Laura on this one. I quit drinking, and I was on my way, and it was time to clean the house out. And I have a white duvet cover, and I drank Canadian Club. And I, brown on white, I was destroyed myself. I went, oh, my God. There were, like, hundreds of bottles, like, you know, the little pint size. Hundreds of bottles, because that was the easiest way for me to get it through that into my house, put it in my robe, put it down my pants, put it in my pantyhose, whatever it was that I needed to do in order to get that little bottle in the house. It's what I had to do. And I just remember that day. And then just recently, I found a couple more bottles when I was cleaning the basement. And, it was like the little tiny bit in there. I called Laura and said, if it was maybe any other time, I might have, like, gone and wanted that drink. But, the luster for, drinking again is just, it's lost its perspective in my life now. So, I just found it. I actually found old brochures. I mean, older, like old. And I took pictures of them. I sent her them. I took pictures of the bottles. I mean, memories. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him thoroughly. Why does he behave like this? And hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation. Why is it he takes that one drink? Could never answer that question. I tried many times. I thought it was because, somebody upset me, because he did that, because she did that, because my mother said no, whatever. Why has become of common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from the drink, as he will do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever it hits his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, therefore, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So, I was, really big on, getting the intellectual part down. For why I drank and, all of that kind of stuff. And so I found out about that little place that's in our brain that, triggers the alcohol. It's like this, like there is a little in there. And it's close to what a heroin addict experiences. And I don't know if that's, like, so true. I really don't. But medically they say that it's true. So I was able to say, well, that's probably the reason why you don't drink the same way that I drink, because, so at least it gave me a reason why I drank the way that I drank, because we always need an excuse. I always found, like, I had to, as an alcoholic, I had to have an excuse for everything. I had to have the reason. I had to always explain myself. These are, like, character flaws that I just had just because me being an alcoholic, which, came out when I was really, really young. So I think these personality traits that I have as an alcoholic were there and instilled when I was very, very young. And then when I picked up the bottle, they just got emphasized a lot more. And came into how I started acting. You know what I mean? These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink. Okay, if you ask him why he started the last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes his excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of havoc an alcoholic drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw the fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Right. You know, we were very irritable if somebody asked us questions or cornered us in a, you know, in a situation in which we didn't really want it. We were uncomfortable with the answer. And, you know, like for me, one of my probably biggest things was my communication. You know, I had a really hard time. So it would almost be like I was going to have a panic attack because I would feel right here somebody was asking me something that I didn't like what they were asking me. And it was so close. I was so emotional. And that happened for like a long time. Of course, I got better as I started to reveal who I was to the women and to, you know, rooms and what was going on with me. But it never really went away. And then I met a woman one time, and I asked her a question, and she did a lot of work with a lot of people, and she said to me, "Denise, you should be well past this." And that never left me because, you know, she was right. You know, like I had, you know, I just had to do more work. And that's what she was trying to tell me. I just had to really do more work in order for me to better myself, like from this book, and get more spiritual in order for me not to have this problem where I was ready to, you know, and I would cry every time because I was just so afraid to ask you a question that I would get really emotional. And, you know, because of the work that I've done, I'm not going to say that I'm 100%, but I'm like 90% most of the time. I mean, I couldn't even go into my employer and like tell them anything, but you might hear the crack in my voice. You know, that's my fear. But I face it today because I know how to face it. And this is what this program teaches me. And then also, you know, I've been working on my communication now probably for like the last 3 years. And it's just, and this, as I told you in the beginning, when I took this position, really helped me in that way. So I've grown a lot in that area that I had a lot of difficulty telling you what I needed, what I wanted, how we could do it. And it affects you in your business. It affects you in your family. It affects you everywhere. When you're too silent and you do not participate, you become like passive and people don't even bother to ask you what's going on with you anymore. So I remember the day where I got an iPad and there was nothing on it. I was like, "What do you do with this thing?" And I had no idea. And somebody said, my niece, "Can I ask you, how do you work this?" She says, "What kind of music do you like, Auntie?" And I'm like, what do I like? No, I didn't even know what I liked. I mean, I had no idea. And I think I had like 3 years of sobriety, and I had no idea what I liked. So you put, like, you go on sites, and so it was like a whole new world that took a long time because I was just learning who I was. I was just finding out the things that I may like, the kind of people I might want to be, the kind of things that I might want to do. I mean, I had no idea. All I knew was I drank. And everything, I cleaned the house, of course, and I cooked the food. But everything was surrounded by alcohol. I never knew what I liked. I never knew that that's what the world was about. So They sound, okay, so sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of havoc an alcoholic straightening bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who beats himself, okay. Once in a while, he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is an obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect they are down for the count. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. The tragic truth is that if the man is a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic. He passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. That was the thing that always confused me, you know, how I always went back. I mean, I just had, like, obviously, you know, I was remorseful about the night before. Something happened, blah, 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 and, you know, 3 days finally passed by. I could now make a phone call. I could now, like, maybe it took a week to see the person, you know, but I could make the phone call, say hi, how you doing? There were times when I would try to see what I did, but I knew that something I did, but I didn't ever know what it was. So, you know, because I was so drunk, so, and you know, these are the things that I was left with, this mental obsession of, like, what did I do? I know it's something bad because I can feel it in my heart. My mind is, like, not good. It's very unhappy, and I don't have any memory of what I did. And then we start to see, or at least I did, I started to see, like, little glimpses. I might get, like, a little story from somebody, or I might run into somebody or something like that. But whenever I was in the store, in the ShopRite or something like that, and I saw some, I would go the other way. I mean, I never wanted to run into anybody because I never knew what I did in order for them. Because I didn't like them, so I had to suspect that they didn't like me. And I didn't like them because I was an alcoholic. And I didn't like them because I needed to be, like, I was a lone wolf, just like Bill. I didn't want to be confronted. I didn't have anything nice to say. I didn't have anything nice that I was going to. I didn't have, like, these plans that everybody else had, these normal families, these normal people going out and all this kind of stuff. I didn't have that going on, you know? I was lonely. I was alone, and I was drinking, and I was sick, and I didn't know how sick I was until I finally realized how sick I was. And so the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how." Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way? And after the third or fourth, pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sake, how did I ever get started again?" Only to have the thought supplanted by, "Well, I'll stop with the sixth drink." Or what's the use anyhow? I used to be so, like, crazy that I would go to the bar and put a shot on the table and, like, dare myself to drink it. And it would be a game. I mean, so, you know, they use that word in here, you know, game. And you know, it became a game, this alcoholic stuff, you know, like testing myself with this willpower and all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, knowing for good that I was going to fail it every time. Because, of course, I remember going to this bar two times and I ran. I ran away. I ran away from that drink on the bar. It made me run away. And the bartender said to me, "I don't know why you do this to yourself." You know? "I don't know why you do this to yourself." He knew more about me than I did. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time." Oh, I said that. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. And unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. But, you know, that glass of alcohol at that point, that shot, was almost like asking for help. Like, that's my problem right there. But I don't know how to get rid of it. And I don't know how to... The only way I know how to get rid of it, like anything else I did, I ran. I just kept running. Running and hiding. I ran. I hid with, like, big sunglasses so that nobody could see my eyes, you know? All, like, that was the type of stuff. Like, I was running, and hiding. And everything, all my lies and all my secrets and everything, you know, I couldn't tell, you know, one straight fact about myself or anything without lying. And then, you know, when I did come into AA, one of the clear things that happened to me was, you know, I would get this God thing and it would really start working and I would really be happy and all of this kind of stuff. And then eventually all the stuff would start piling up again where I wasn't talking and I wasn't releasing all of this and I was becoming toxic inside again. So therefore I would start drinking again and God was out the window. And all the lies came back. Just like it was a natural predisposition for me. God is out and lying's in. You know? So unless locked up, he may die or go permanently insane. You know, my family wanted to, you know, put me away. And my sister thought that she would be able to. But I told her, I said, "Well, you don't pay my bills, do you?" She says, "No." So I said, "I don't think legally you can put me away, no matter how much, you know, you don't like what I'm doing." So, but this is how far people will go, you know. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. There is a solution. Almost none. I'm probably not doing this fast enough. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching and leveling of our pride. The confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. I had no idea what that meant. The leveling of our pride. Confession of shortcomings. You know, I was perfect. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we had not even dreamed. Another statement that I had never understood. The great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. And that goes into the gradual, you know, like if you have an immediate gradual, how you have to work at it, which has revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do for ourselves. If we are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a positive position where life was becoming impossible and we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of an intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. Well, you know, like I remember when I was getting, I was really looking. I really was like looking for a solution here. What was I going to do? Because I really realized that I was really in trouble. I really realized that I had a problem. For the first time in my life, I knew that I couldn't stop drinking. And there was no rehab, nothing. I'd been through that. They're, you know, back on the merry-go-round once again. And I don't know if many of you know him, but I called Otto. Otto was an old-timer, and you just didn't call Otto, especially if you were drunk, you know? And I was, like, drunk, and it was like I was going to go into, a detox in, like, a week. And I had called Night Watch, and I asked for somebody that would be not in my area because they probably would know me, and then I wouldn't be able to show up, you know? All this pride. Pride, you know, I didn't make it last time. You know, I have to show up again. I actually took myself to meetings outside of this area, so that I didn't run into anybody that I knew. And I would drive miles. My sponsor, like, said, "Okay, do what you got to do." And then one day, she knew I was getting better, because I said I went to Rahway. Ah, that's so close, you know. So, a certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. For years, he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of Dr. Young, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment in unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of the mind. Yeah, so this was me. You know, I go away, I get out, and I drink because I don't know how to handle real life. So he returned to the doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to place himself under lock and key or hire. Now, don't forget, this book was, you know, written a really long time ago, where they didn't really have the answers that we have today. You know, they don't have the treatments that we have today, you know. So they don't have a program like this, like what we have today, where we help one another and we're able to help another person that may be drinking and wants to stop, and, you know, work with them. So just remember that. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He could go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. So your daily practice of 10, 11, and 12, and all these principles in your lifestyle, right? All these steps here. Some of our alcoholic readers may think that they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover." So they didn't have all this history that we have. So exceptions to the cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what we called a vital spiritual experience. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. You get all that? Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I have been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Upon hearing this, this friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed, the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions were good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital experience that would be necessary. So they're talking about, you know, the spiritual change that we go through, finding God in these rooms, finding God in our lives, finding God in our heart, and being guided by a power greater than ourselves. So, and it takes different time lapses for people to get it. Sometimes it's really fast, sometimes it's really slow. It's an everyday, some people have to really work at it, other people do not, you know. Here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, if we prefer a design of living. When I hear that flimsy reed, I always think of like floating under the water, and that's the only breath that you can take, and that's how, that's your channel up to God. That's the air, that's the God air that we're getting, giving us life, you know? And without that, I would be drowning. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt, seen, means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of ours what religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. This should be an entirely personal affair which each one decides for himself in the light of past associations or his present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such memberships. In the following chapters, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it, then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many who once were in this class are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. Clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this. So that's the end of There Is a Solution, and I'm thankful that I was able to find my guide and to be able to practice all these in all my affairs and continue to learn today because it's never over. And life throws me a lot of things, and I just have to learn how to handle them. I was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. So I wanted to, you know, let you all know. And I received such great support from my women and my network and from my yoga people and also from my job. You know, God works in very strange ways. He got me out of that other job. I got this other job. I didn't even have medical insurance. And these people, I was like, am I going to not have a job? And I'm still there. And they have supported me because the only thing that they say is as long as you get better. So, it's like been a journey, and God wasn't done there. God decided to take all the plumbing out of my house. So, I had no toilet for 3 weeks, and I had leaks in the basement. I had leaks in the kitchen. In order for me to take a shower at one point, when I did still have a toilet yet, then I had to put a bucket in the soffit above the cabinets so that I could take a shower for 10 minutes or then it was going to overflow. So then everything was closed down and I had to get a new bathroom, you know, and I didn't know how I was going to do this. I'm single, I have this house, I have to work, I have to go to treatments, and everybody came through. And it's just an amazing thing. And I'm doing really well now. Not quite over it, but it's all coming to... But God works in strange ways because, you know, I have a feeling that God wanted to show me all the love that's here and that I might be missing and that, you know, it's so important and to share. And it's just amazing. I don't know about the plumbing, but I will tell you one thing. My house was sick and I was sick. So we're getting better together. So it's just an amazing thing. And that's all I got.